Welcome to this Business of Music and Poetry podcast, where the life of a creative meets the real world. I'm Michael Amade, the host of World Poetry Open Mic and The Michael Amade Show, publisher of World Poetry Magazine, musician, poet, and author of more books than I should mention. My collaborator and co-conspirator in this project is none other than Clifford Brooks. Cliff is the author of Athena Departs and The Draw of Broken Eyes and Whirling Metaphysics. He's a founder of the Southern Collective Experience and is the creative force behind the Blue Mountain Review. Our guest today is Dave Brandwine. Dave Brandwine is the frontman, guitarist, and one of the creative forces behind the phenomenal band Turquoise. Bouncing male-female harmonies, strutting guitars, wild horn arrangements, and interminable grooves, a spirit takes shape on stage nightly for Turquoise via larger-than-life performances. Among numerous critical plaudits, the New Yorker claimed, Turquoise delivers horn-filled funk incorporating elements of R&B, psychedelic pop, gospel, afro-pop, new wave, classic rock, and just about any genre that gets people dancing. The Brooklyn-based Nonette ignite an explosion of energy punctuated by neon hues, deft musicality, and show-stopping sing-alongs in their newest EP, Kodachrome. Touring incessantly, up until 2020, of course, in support of four full-length studio albums, EPs, and live releases, they've lit up stages everywhere from Bonnaroo, Halloween, Okeechobee, Electric Forest, and Mountain Jam to Telluride Jazz, High Sierra, and Lockin, in between gracing stages at legendary spots such as Red Rocks, Terminal 5, and the Fillmore, to name a few. Since emerging in 2011 with their self-titled debut, the group have quietly animated a movement. But that's enough about that. Let's get into the interview. There's some great things that Dave brings up about making a living as a musician, playing music, and it's great to hear about his journey. So without any further ado, here is our interview with Dave Brandwine.
And tonight, on This Business of Music and Poetry, we bring you Dave Brandwine, the legendary frontman of the band we all know as Turquoise. Dave, how's it going, boss?
Oh, man, it's going well. Legendary, that's a strong word. But you know what feels legendary right now is you happen to be interviewing me on the day that we, for the first time in 14 months, have gotten together as a band, Turquoise, and played some music. So I'm feeling really good right now. Today feels legendary. Man, thank you so much for having me.
Dude, it's fantastic to see you, man. It's surreal to be able to have this conversation. So I want to jump in with both feet and grab this enthusiasm. Right. What's it feel like to be playing music again? What's it feel like to be back in the studio?
It's crazy, man. Well, over the whole, pandemic, the studio was what I was doing, but it was very isolated feeling. I was, mixing, editing, and doing a little bit of recording with some people, but like never really actually, playing with a full band. I mean, standing, playing guitar with a drum kit behind me, and like this, it's crazy. I mean, in some ways it feels like, oh my God, it's been forever. And in other ways it feels like, we never left, and just kind of clicks right back in. We're certainly brushing off the cobwebs a little bit, I mean, inevitably there's going to be some, I haven't played guitar for 2.5 straight hours for the last 14 months. So that's going to be something I got to like work my way up to a little bit. I think everybody's feeling that. But overall, man, we're having a blast so far. So yeah, it's awesome.
That's, dude, I love hearing about that, man. Going from the present to the past, how did Turquoise get its sound?
Well, I've always said early on, we used to just, because two of the biggest things that Taylor and I always, emulated. I mean, of course, there were so many, but Talking Heads, Sly and the Family Stone, when we were sort of forming the band, that was a lot of the stuff we were like, in terms of like video footage that we were finding from like YouTube, from old stuff and albums we were listening to. That was kind of like for us, the sort of, we sort of tried to create a synergy between those two things. So, it's funk, and it's definitely, it's rooted in that, especially groove-wise, but lyrically and on the vocal end of things, I think there's a lot of influence from, like I said, Talking Heads, who I'm sure we'll be talking about that again later. I grew up being a total Beatle freak, as was Taylor. So I think that works its way in, but the fast answer has always been Sly meets Talking Heads, and I'm sticking with that as a decent. I don't know if it's perfect, but it's a decent way to describe using it.
Now, Dave, when you started this project, and this is something I was just talking to a producer friend of mine about.
Yeah.
When you started this project, was that always the aim? Did you always say, "Hey, Talking Head meets Sly meets this stuff," or did it just naturally happen?
No, it's only when being asked the question that I have to sort of pull that and be like, okay, where did it come from? But it happened more naturally than that. It was just that was what we were listening to. That was what we were watching. But, you know, when asked, I'm like, okay, I could name like 30 bands that we love, or I could, you know, it's sort of the best, you know, estimation that we've been able to, the most succinct estimation we've been able to do so far.
But I think being able to do that's a big thing too.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. And it's like, no one went, oh, well, don't compare us to this band or this band, whatever. But it's like, man, that's the stuff we love. I don't care. I mean,
right.
Of course, we listen to James Brown and the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Zapp and Roger. And it's like, who wants to hear me list 30 bands? Although I can do it if you want. More than I could probably list 100. But yeah.
So I know, you know, every musician, you know, I jokingly say this, every musician like a superhero, right? We have our own origin stories.
Right.
Not that I'm equating musicians as superheroes, but you know what I mean?
I will.
So how did you kind of find yourself falling in love with not only music, but playing music? Because there's a difference there.
Like a lot of people, I started, you know, I took piano lessons as a kid. I actually played trumpet because my grandfather played trumpet. So I did that in my elementary school band. But then I really leaned more into the piano and I love playing like classical music and Tchaikovsky and stuff like that. So that was sort of like, I actually almost entered, of course, I listened to, you know, pop music on the radio, but I kind of entered through that world in terms of playing. I was actually approaching from a little bit more of a classical angle, but that very quickly changed when I switched to, once I plugged in an electric guitar, it was like, okay, well, I mean, I still play piano, but that was kind of over for me personally. I just, it was a better fit. And I was just, again, total Beatle freak. So I was like, you know, that was my blueprint. And I was like, I want to, you know, be a songwriter and play and sing at the same time. And that's, so I started to cultivate that after about, when I've been 3 or 4 years playing piano, I switched over to guitar pretty much full time at that point.
Very, very nice. You know, I think it's always interesting to see, because I started as a piano player and taking lessons and then switched to guitar myself. I think there's a moment, right? It has, you know, people always make the joke like, oh, girls like guitar better, you know, or whatever. But
right.
But I don't really, at least for me, and I have a feeling for you, it probably wasn't that. It was more like the electricity.
Byproduct.
It's a byproduct. Yeah. Yeah, you do cool stuff and then girls show up. Like, that's the difference.
It's a byproduct of it,
yeah.
But it also just felt better. Exactly. And,
absolutely.
And then at that, I mean, I guess I left out an important part, which is that at that same moment that I made that transition, it was also a transition in the type of music I was listening to. It's like I went to, you know, I was going to like Tower Records or whatever, The Wall or wherever you bought CDs back then. And I was, you know, I said I would just buy whatever, like the, you know, whatever was on the radio. But one week I saw the Beatles, the White Album, and it just said the Beatles on it. And it was white. And I was like, that's so cool. And I bought that and I just put it on. It was like that. I mean, that was it for me. I was like, you know, then for my upcoming birthday, I asked for every Beatles album and I got it. And my parents were very generous and nice to buy me every Beatles album. And that coincided with the moment when I switched over the guitar. And then I had this Beatles songbook where it has all the sort of chords and chord charts and stuff like that. And that's really how I learned. I mean, I had a teacher, but I learned music theory, guitar, everything just by learning how to play every single Beatles song. That's like,
by the way,
the foundation of my musical upbringing.
Such a good way to learn that, by the way.
Like, oh, no, said, dude, like, that's like the best way, man.
Like, damn, why didn't I do that? No, so how old were you when you said you asked for those albums for your birthday? How old were you?
Middle school, like 7th grade.
Yep. Yep.
So I guess I was probably like 11. I'm a little young for my grade, so like 11 or something like that.
I think that's the magic age, man. Like,
yeah,
right, dude. Around there.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's true. I never thought about that. Yeah, man.
How cool is that, man? And then of course, like, you know, you're listening to some of the best stuff in that time. So what occurs to me is, as you're talking about the music you're listening to, like even just the bands you're just listing, you're listing the best music. Like this, oh, if you go down a list, like right. Well, I mean, but like, you know, I think the thing is, you were talking about what you listen to is what informs it. Right. So it's like one thing that I always am talking to musicians about, and I'm also talking to writers about too. It's like what you're reading or what you're listening to drastically informs what you're putting out into the world. So make sure you're listening to the good, like good stuff.
Right.
You know, and well,
I remember even, I think it was someone asked McCartney, like Colbert asked like McCartney recently, like, why, you know, why are you Paul McCartney? Like what makes you that? Yeah. And he just, I mean, you know, in his funny Paul way, was just like, you know, all this stuff went in. It was sort of like all this input, like putting it into a computer. And I started like, you know, printing it out, you know, it's like, yeah, it's all about like what you put in absolutely, you know, determines the type of output that you're going to get. Of course, given the skills, I mean, you have to build the ability to recreate certain things and understand. That's why using that chord book was such a great way to do it. Cause it was like, oh, if I want to understand how this motif works in this part of this song, now I'm really inside of it. I've learned how to play it and how to write it at the same time. And of course you don't want to copy it directly, but you pick up those little tricks and recreate them where you want to.
So that's powerful. And yeah, I think that's a thing that we all can pay better attention to sometimes, you know. So you start playing guitar, you're playing your way through the Beatles songbook
catalog. Yeah.
which is great. And then, so how did you get into playing in bands? You know, there's a lot of people play guitar and just play guitar in their bedroom their whole life.
Right.
How'd you move into bands?
I mean, again, just being that, into all those British rock band, you know, Beatles, Stones, The Who, and Pink Floyd and Zeppelin, and it was just, you know, that was my second nature. I was like, okay, well, now I play guitar, now I have to start a band. So I actually played in the same band with, you know, more or less with one member changing a few times throughout, like from seventh grade through when I left for college. I played in one band, and it was mostly original. I mean, we definitely did covers, but it was original stuff. And so yeah, I didn't do the whole, like, you know, school band thing. There was a jazz band and stuff like that, but no, I was more focused on the extra curricular, like just going over to the drummer's house and jamming and playing and writing and stuff. So it was pretty much simultaneous to everything we're talking about, right when I, like, switching to guitar, you know, diving into the Beatles catalog and starting a band were all at the same moment, at that, when they're 11, 12 years old. And yeah, I mean, it's just been that way ever since.
See, I think that's a really cool thing. Cause I talk about to a lot of people also that, you know, playing music is part of it, but playing with the band is different. It's a different art form. It's a different way of playing. And I think not a single thing against, you know, middle school or high school jazz band and whatever, but there's something there's something that's kind of cool about music at that age when it's not sanctioned by adults. Like
you have to. Well, exactly. Yeah. It's not. Yeah. Well, it feels more fun for that reason.
Right, exactly. Sure. Yeah.
And then also you have to figure out the power structure and the dynamics of it. And that's stuff that is still relevant to this day. It's like, you know, yeah, exactly. There's no teacher to be like, hey, quiet, he's speaking or whatever. You know, it's like we're all yelling over each other and we're figuring out, no, I like it better this way. And you got to learn to work with other people. I mean, that's actually like, it's almost like a better life skill that you learn than you do doing it the way you do in school, where there's somebody telling you exactly how to do it. You're actually figuring it out when you're in a band in a garage. You know, it's like that's, you can't replicate that kind of experience. That's essential, you know? And again, we're still doing it to this day, you know, just
it is funny.
An hour ago, we were still doing it.
Well, so, I mean, and let me ask you that question. Cause I run into this too, you know, I still know people from high school that I used to play in bands with, you know, and they all grew up and had kids and became insurance salesmen or whatever. Yeah. And yet here I am still feeling like I'm in part of me is like still firmly stuck in high school world. Like I'm still just doing the same stuff, man. Do you have friends from back then have you noticed just the difference in the way that the lives separated by the choice of what you decided to dedicate yourself to, or has there been pros or cons to that in your mind?
Yeah, you know, it's so weird because I don't have you know, perspective outside, you know, too much of my own experience. So I don't know how it's been for all of them, but I am one of the few. It's not like I know a bunch of people who pursued this and continued on and do it fully professionally. So I certainly think that's been a unique experience for me. I think that sometimes I dream about a 9-to-5 job and stability and, you know, financial stability, a regular schedule, you know, anything basically stable, you know. It's like I sometimes dream about that. And, you know, it's that if I really stop and think about it, it's like, wow, like this is crazy that I chose to do this for a living. And I, you know, thinking back to when the band started and just getting in the van and starting touring, it's like there wasn't a plan. I don't know what we were thinking, but we were just going with our instincts. And it's almost in like these recent years, and now even with the pandemic too, like really waking up and be like, oh, okay, well, I've chosen this. There's no going back now because I really haven't developed anything else. So now I'm putting a lot more thought into how to keep it going and keep advancing. And you know, it's not all fun and games anymore like it used to be. But man, it's overall, I'm certainly glad that I think that there's two sides to it. You have to be thankful that you get to do what you love to do the most as a living. But also, when music used to be really sort of a respite and a sort of a haven, a safe haven away from other things that were stressors in life, you know, now it is part of, it's your job. So there's also a little bit of a trade-off there, I think. It's kind of like, it's not just purely something that you do out of love because it's your career, you know, but but you got to try to tap into that love for it as much as you possibly can, which here we are again, we're doing it, you know?
Yeah. I think that that's a thing that I really had to contend with myself, which is I had to remind myself and actively try to keep falling in love with music over and over again.
Right.
Cause you know, you've been on the road for, you know, X amount of months and you're just like, dude, when I have quiet time, I literally just want quiet time.
Oh, like, we're not like putting on music on the long drives. Like we're listening to podcasts or we're, you know, I mean,
there you go.
I don't want to say that we never do. I mean, we certainly do sometimes, but that's the best thing when you hear, especially because not only for me, it's like I know what the chords are when I hear a song. I can picture the changes. I'm thinking about what kind of, you know, I'm also thinking about production, like what microphone did they use? It's hard for me to actually just have a song come on and not really be thinking about all these different aspects of it that make it not a recreational activity to listen to. I'm like picking things apart. I'm not trying to, it's just, it's happening because that's what I do for a living. But that's the best when you actually occasionally still something so unique or awesome will come on, or I'll discover something when it makes you not analyze and it makes you stop thinking. And you just, that's those moments that you're talking about where you fall in love again with the music. And I love that. It doesn't happen every day, but it does, you know, there's a handful of bands and things that, and sometimes going back to the old stuff too, those very bands that we were talking about earlier, when I just put it back on, it's like all of a sudden my brain frees up and it's not trying to figure out, you know, what, how they, you know, how many mics are on the drum kit and what synth they're using and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So, those are the best. I mean, when you can actually just still enjoy listening to music, it's few and far between, honestly, but it's really magical when it does happen.
I can think of a few moments I've had that, but you're right. It's not every day. You talked about when you jumping in the van and not having a plan and everything, but there was a step that you made between high school and doing that. Right. So say you're playing bands in this band in high school and middle school. What's the step between there and then you heading on the road saying I'm staking my claim to be a pro here?
Well, I went to Berklee College of Music. And you know, I had a great time there. I think it's a great school. It's pretty different now than it was when I went there. It's a lot harder to get in now. So what was unique about it when I went was that like I sent like my rock band's album and I rated myself at how good I was. that was it. Like, and then I got in, you know, it was like, now you have to have a pretty decent level of.
That's amazing.
Oh no, it was, yeah, it's pretty crazy. I mean, I think it was something like an 80% acceptance rate when I,
wow.
And now it's dropped way down. And now you have to have a basic understanding of like their version of music theory, which is rooted really in jazz and proficiency on guitar. When I was like, kind of, they would take anyone, and then they would rate you when you got there, and that would affect what classes you'd take. But I think it was actually a unique and cool thing that, I mean, I'm sure that there's still tons of amazing, in fact, I'm positive there's still tons of amazing people coming out of there. But I think it was a unique thing back when I went there that they could take these sort of kids who were just in rock bands, and then they would get this different kind of training than they ever would normally get. So it worked really well for me. I always like to say I learned just as much what I didn't want to do as what I did want to do at Berklee. But I stayed there all 4 years, and by the, you know, I was in a few bands, and then by the end of that, that's when Taylor and I lived in a house together. We made these first demo recordings that became what Turquoise is. And then, so that's really the step. I mean, but there was a lot of years, of learning, music theory, production, music business, you know, guitar technique, a lot of stuff. And then by the end of it, it was like, all right, this is the band that we're now in, and we're going to just, everyone just like moved to New York, and we just, that's where it picks up with the not having a plan thing. But we knew we wanted to play, you know, that was all we knew.
Well, and I think, you know, and I wanted to make sure to have that in there, because I think there's some people like, oh, just get in the van. All right, that's cool.
No, don't just get in the van. You should learn a few things before you get in the van. Especially don't get into a stranger's van, by the way.
Right. Yeah, definitely not a stranger's van. Have your own van.
Even your own van. You should learn a few things.
Exactly. So, okay. So, and that's great stuff. So when you say, when you said like, okay, we all moved to New York, we're like, we don't have a plan, you start touring. Now did you get some sort of booking agent or something at the time? I mean, I'm trying to do this for the musicians who are listening and try to kind of get some grassroots ideas here. How did you go about that process?
Yeah, so at first we didn't, and we were just playing in New York like, you know, every month, and maybe sometimes going to Boston, sometimes going to DC, just putting on shows, inviting everyone we knew. That's what I mean by no plan. It was like, I mean, the plan was one by one each show. And then eventually we saw some other friends' bands starting to like actually tour. Cause I had been our booking agent for a long time. I even managed to get us on a couple festivals. So like we did Bear Creek Festival in 2011 before we even had a booking agent. And I cold emailed Paul there, and he gave us a shot. He was like, all right, come down and do two sets. And you know, we did it, and it was life changing. It was awesome. And then we did get with an agent who was kind of known, this dude Tom, who's known for kind of doing that. He'd done it with you know, Disco Biscuits and a bunch of other bands that were more, I mean, that's sort of what moved us more into the jam scene, because we really weren't before then. We were playing like some of the more like Lower East Side, like hipster New York kind of clubs. And then he started booking us, and it was like, okay, well, we're going to start making these concentric circles kind of outward of different markets. And then, you know, once you've done well enough in each one, you graduate to, you know, doing them less often and adding new markets. And this, it was definitely a formula that he showed us and he taught us. But that was also when we learned how to play longer. Cause it was like, wait, we're supposed to play 3 hours in this, you know, dive bar, you know, three nights in a row, and people don't want you to repeat any songs. It's like, all right, well, now this song's gonna go from 3 minutes to 9 minutes long. You know, like, we're like, we're not gonna add too many more. We, you know, we're gonna add time to the existing songs. We're not gonna add all those other songs. Well, I mean, we did both, of course. But no, so that, yeah, no, we did. We got an agent, and that's how that formula started happening. So definitely, you know, that was what taught us how to sort of build it. And then,
that's great.
Yeah. And then it's just, you know, at a certain point, once we did get to the point where we're playing pretty much most cities nationally. And then now we, luckily years later, we get to pick and choose a little bit more of what we want to do. But at our peak, we were up to almost 170 shows a year. And so that doesn't even include travel days. I mean, so that was pretty crazy. Now, you know, we've toned it down, and again, we get to sort of pick and choose the better gigs now, which is, although right now we'll take whatever.
Yeah, don't hold on. No, yeah. I, I saw that you had played, is it true? You guys had played Red Rocks at one point. Is that true?
We played Red Rocks three times, but all three times were opening for band. Well, the first time, was Lettuce. And then it was, I think, Green Sky Bluegrass. And then it was Umphreys.
No kidding. I'm like 10 minutes. I'm 10 minutes from Red Rocks right now.
Oh, really?
And, yeah. And I played there the first time. When I was 17 years old, I had some older kids who had gotten an opening slot before Los Lobos and Dave Matthews Band back in the day. Wow. And they called me like, hey, our bass player just got sent to the hospital. We need a bass player. Can you come learn the whole set and play tonight? I'm like, yep. I just like walked out of high school. Wow. Like, screw this. I'm going to go learn how to play. Gonna play the set. And that was my first time there. But I was just saw that you were there. I'm like, man, that would have been great to see you. But we will come catch you.
Yeah, well, and the goal is to come back. We were booked to go back there with the Remain in Light tour with Jerry and Adrian. And just because of the pandemic, it got postponed. And so we're just still in the midst of figuring out when that might happen. But no, we very much look forward to going back there. It's an incredible
when
venue.
When it does, I will make my way. I'll make my way over.
And I believe the only venue that we and the Beatles have both played. So
see, that's the one. Yeah. Yeah. People remember this.
It was the Cavern Club.
Dave, let me ask you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I was gonna ask Dave, playing with Umphreys or opening for them, what was that experience like?
Well, it was a little intimidating. I mean, they're insanely good at what they do. I mean, just their like just technical proficiency. I mean, I love their songs too, but I mean, just yeah. I mean, we had to just do us. You know, like we're not gonna be able to compete with that. But no, it was awesome, dude. They were so nice, so complimentary. They said nice things about us into the mic during their set. And they had our horn players come out and join them for a bunch of songs. So it was really really awesome.
Nice.
And same for In Green Sky. We came, you know, we joined them on stage for some stuff and did some collaboration stuff. So, no, we had a great Red Rock experience pretty much every time we played there. It was awesome.
That's
amazing.
I think well, and touring really seems to be really the place where your band really is centered, right? Some acts are recording acts, some acts are, you know, they might play, but like, you know, Enya is a recording act. let's be straight up, right?
They're not jamming
Enya, right?
Coming out like 11-minute versions of
right. I don't know exactly, but I mean, you definitely seem to be a band that functions live. But here's the thing that I've seen: there's a lot of bands, including I heard about the Neville Brothers was the same thing. Like they're just fantastic live. But then sometimes they didn't translate to the studio very well, right? Like there's that dichotomy. So it strikes me your band does that really well. So how do you go about thinking about the recording process versus the live process?
Yeah, that's a complicated one, because I've ended up over time developing different approaches to trying studio stuff. Because of that very reason, like, you know, early on, we pretty much were just throwing microphones up and trying to capture what we already knew how to play. And there, I wasn't as advanced in terms of like my production skills or vision for it. But you know, so I think there's like really good energy that mimics a little bit more of the live energy on some of the earlier recordings, especially when it gets to something like Digitonium, which was in 2015. That was where I was like, okay, now, you know, I'd been doing other studio projects and learning more about production and exploring some more like hi-fi tech, you know, production techniques and programming stuff and samples and different things like that. So that was when I was like, okay, I don't want to worry about live. I want to just make the best album that we possibly can. So there was a switch at that point. And then when it came, I was like, we're going to worry about it later. Trust me, I worried about it later. I was like, when we finished Digitonium, I was like, oh man, like now we got to figure out how to do this live. But what we ended up doing was this sort of cool thing where we was like, you got to let go of it sounding verbatim, you know, exactly like the recordings. You got to have fun with it. You got to bring that live energy to it. I mean, some of the songs, the dynamics on the recording don't change very much from beginning to end. It's pretty much, it has different exciting things that come in and out, but in terms of how loud it is or how intensely the band's playing, it's kind of a flat line, and that's sort of the style of that recording, like a lot of hip hop stuff that we were listening to. And but then live, we bring a totally different energy to it, and we make it the jam. You know, we make it peak whatever the solo is, and do like a big last chorus. And so, and then we've had times where, you know, we did that Quadrochrome thing a couple years ago. Now I've lost track of time. I have no idea when anything was, but a couple years ago we did that Quadrochrome thing, and it was like, let's get back to just let's get in the studio and actually play. Let's not program stuff. Let's not. You know, so we sort of almost have like two models of making records, and we've been working on a ton of recordings, and we're starting to sort of mishmash them a little bit more, which is really exciting and cool. But yeah, it is, you know, I mean, I love our recordings, especially the more recent ones. So it's just, man, I mean, live music fans, you know, that again, because of that scene that we came up in and the way that we started playing those clubs and those circuits and those festivals, I mean, just a bulk of our fans are just live music fans. So as great as recordings as we can make, you know, they're always going to love the live show. And I totally get it. You know, I love both. I think it's great to be able to bounce back and forth.
It's definitely a gift, and it's to be able to do both, I think. You know, I can definitely commend, like, I think you and the band are a really good model for that. And it's cool to hear that you're doing different approaches. I think that that's what you have to do to kind of keep things interesting and
definitely.
And fun as you develop and you grow. So, okay. So we're talking about touring, we're talking about recording, we're talking about all this. And I'm sure this is a never ending topic that has been asked of you many times, but then March of last year happens, and everything just like, you know, the transmission gets jammed into park on everything.
Yeah.
How did that feel for you? And kind of what was your world like right in those moments?
Well, I mean, for however many years, I mean, since like 2012 or 2013 or so, the longest break we'd ever taken was 5 weeks. So as horrible and tragic as it was for the touring industry and music in general, you know, I'm not going to lie. There was some sense of like, before actually realizing how long it was going to be and how insanely, you know, apocalyptic things were going to feel, there was a moment of relief of like, okay, so things are going to get like pushed a couple months, and wow, I'm actually going to be able to like be home, and I can, you know, start up a routine, like I was saying before, like more of a routine, and have, you know, and then that quickly just went away, and it was like, oh man, when is this going to be over? And it was so, but at first it wasn't all doom and gloom because it was this very, very unique chance. You know, I mean, I got to spend a bunch of time with family. Once we knew it was safe and tested, and I went and stayed with my parents for like 3 months. I mean, that's probably not going to be able to happen again. You know, it's like, so in some ways, I think everybody's found silver linings in this thing. But don't get me wrong. I mean, we're very, very happy to be coming back and playing, tried to make the best of it as much as possible, but you know, and it really wasn't one moment of realization. It was a slow unfolding thing of like, oh, cause you know, they're going to push it a couple months, and oh, I guess those festivals aren't going to happen. They're going to push to the fall. Never mind. There's going to be no shows in the fall. Now they're pushing to 2021. There's, you know, each few months you were learning like, oh wow, this is not coming back. And now it's starting to, so.
Yeah, no. And so happy that it is, you know, like, wow. And talking to some friends of mine who are booking agents too, it's like, It appears that 2022 is going to be just absolutely bonkers, and the end of 2021 is going to even be ramping more and more and more.
Yeah,
I hope so. Yeah, hope so. So now coming out of this, I mean, obviously you had some time, you know, like, and you mentioned kind of being in the studio, right? Like this whole time, as you would be, right? Like, well, I'm sitting around, I'm going to create.
Yeah, I mean, right. It's almost like, you know, I figured all those times where I'm squeezing in sessions and getting recordings done for like 4 days when we're home between shows, like, well, if I can get the next 3 albums done and some side projects and whatever, if I can get all that done, maybe I can, once you start touring again, I can actually relax when I come home in between shows. I'll have all that recording done for the next, you know, I mean, I've worked on a lot of records over this break. So absolutely, that's how I filled the time.
Sure. Oh, so that's great. So as far as, and so we're, you know, of course, when those things come out, you know, we'll be really excited for them. And what is the, now that things are starting to open up, and I mean, obviously there's some tour dates on your website and all that, some things coming up, but what do you think the changes of the plans for your, you and your group are going to kind of be going forward? Not doesn't have to be specifics, but like, are you rethinking some strategies? Are you rethinking some ways you're going to go about things?
It's sort of like what I was saying about just when you, it's not one moment of realization. It's like, you're slowly just figuring out how things are going to unfold. We're still in that right now. So it's sort of like, we could have all these ideas of what we want to do and what we would ideally do, but there's just such, you know, limitations on everything still. So really we're just, when we, I mean, it's cool that offers are coming in, but we're figuring out what feels safe, what feels responsible, what feels doable, and also just, you know, easing our way back in and getting comfortable again. And things are more happening to us right now than we're making them happen. We're you know what I mean? It's like, we don't have the luxury of making too many decisions other than, okay, we're gonna play, and we field each sort of opportunity as it comes in. And but yeah, so I mean, I think that we're gonna continue to have longer. I don't know when the next time we're gonna do like a 10-week tour is, which we used to do quite frequently. So that's different, but again, it's not really by choice. It's just kind of how things are.
Yeah, fair enough. And now you had mentioned in conversation that you'd been working on some solo stuff as well, which is, yeah, it's a separate project. Could you tell us a little bit about what you were developing with that and how it's kind of different from the main band?
Yeah, it's very different from Turquoise. A lot more in the vein of what we were talking about, the kind of music I played when I was growing up. So it's more in the pop rock vein. There's some acoustic guitars involved and things like that. So, you know, piano. And so I played a lot of the instruments. I had a lot of friends play on it. This sort of ties into the last thing you asked too about how our plan's changing. Another thing is with both my solo project, which, you know, I'll give more details about soon. I'm sort of still in the process of finalizing it and you know, figuring out what the release plans are and if there are any live, you know, tour plans. But I've also worked on side projects with other band members and a bunch of Turquoise recordings. What you were asking about, how do, you know, plans change or things are being done differently now, is that it feels like not a good time to release things. So all the stuff that I've been working on, we've really been building, you know, putting it in the can, and we're just like kind of waiting and figuring out when, you know, again, for all of the above projects, when the best time to release it is. I mean, I know that some stuff has been released and been really well received in the pandemic, but I think a lot of it's been in the much larger pop world. You know, music is like the soundtrack to people's lives, and when their lives are like sitting inside watching Netflix, there's really not the much soundtrack to be had. So it's just, I just feel like it just hasn't been that great of a time to release music. I mean, I want to, we're sitting on so much stuff. I'm sitting on my soul stuff, but I am excited for it. Now that things are starting up again, I am going to give more details soon. I would say probably sometime in the, you know, maybe in the fall, I'll release that solo material. And so, yeah, more to come on that.
Okay, very cool. And I was just thinking as you were talking about, like, man, you know, no one wants to be known as the summer party anthem of 2020. Like, exactly. One.
The pandemic party band. Yeah. That would suck. Riots, so much.
Everything. Like, no. Oh, man. I mean, yeah, you're right. It's just, it is a strange time for releasing things. That totally makes a lot of sense to me.
It's tough. Yeah. Tough time for it.
So for all the musicians we have, and of course there's so much bleed over, right? And that's one of the reasons this show works for different creatives. But if there's a musician who's listening, who's wanting to kind of pursue it, and say someone like you towards the end of your high school career, or even someone in school, you know, in college, like you were, and they're wanting to kind of pursue a path like yours in music, is there something that you would want to share with them that you think would be valuable?
I mean, you know, mostly that it's difficult. It's rare that somebody gets that, you know, hits that perfect, you know, jump off point really, really early in their career and really blow up at a young age. And if you do, that presents its own whole set of challenges for the rest of your life and how you're going to perceive things. And if you know, you start at the top, that's kind of a scary place to start. So for most people, and certainly for me and for us as a band, like, it was really slowly working our way up. But I'm really happy that that's how it went. So I would just say, don't be discouraged by having to slowly work your way up. Be willing to be patient and not have the greatest life and make the most money for the first, like, you know, 7 to 10 years that you do it.
Yeah.
And if you do, you know, if you keep putting the work in and you surround yourself with good people and you make the best music you can, I believe that slowly and surely you work your way up, and that is the slow and steady, you know, it's so cliche, but it does kind of win the race. Cause it's like, you know, there are exceptions to that. People who blow up out of the gate and then they end up having these amazing careers, but man, there are very few. I mean, that's certainly the exception and not the rule. So I think patience and building something meaningful slowly, which is a really good way to look at it. And you have to be prepared for that. If you want it to, you know, you want to be make a ton of money right out of the gate, definitely don't go into
Well, and you know, I think what you're talking about is a really important point, because I think you know, for all of the good they may do, you know, those like the TV talent shows, you know, American Idol, just really kind of it gives people just such a wrong impression of how music is.
I couldn't agree more. That's what I've always said. And I've watched it for like entertainment purposes.
Sure.
And I can like, you know, oh, like who's gonna get, you know, knocked off this week or whatever. But like, I do think overall it's really unhealthy with those things, but because it gives this idea that it's like you're gonna get your shot. Mm-hmm. And then if you're good enough, that's it. It's gonna be in that moment that boom, now you're famous. And it's like that is just the farthest thing from the truth for 99.9999% of musicians. And it's just like, it's not about your shot. Every day is your shot and you're building it. You know, it's not it's not like, I mean, sure, you could get an audition for something particular, but it's certainly not been my experience, and I think it paints a very unrealistic picture for a lot of people, a lot of singers, you know, especially because that tends to be who is featured on those shows. I don't really know. I haven't watched one of those shows in quite a long time. I don't know. Might have magicians and stuff on now. What's going on?
You know, I think that the point you just made, and I think this resonates across the board, is every day is your shot.
Right.
That's the killer line right there. Both Cliff and I want to say thank you for spending your time with us, and we want to thank Dave Brandwine for a really enlightening, beautiful, and motivating conversation. You can find Dave at turquazeband.com. That's turquazeband.com. You can find Cliff Brooks at cliffbrooks.com or at southerncollectiveexperience.com. You can find myself at michaelamade.com, worldpoetrymagazine.com, and worldpoetryopenmic.com. Until next time, remember to be yourself. The world needs your authenticity. Do the hard work and conquer your obstacles creatively. Remember to follow your heart, for it's easy to lose your head in this business of music and poetry.